Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Hey Amud Bet, about 17 lines up. Gemara here is discussing certain areas that require a tziyun, a demarcation, to indicate that they have tumah there. And the Gemara told us that you only need a demarcation when there's tumat oel involved. The Gemara challenged that from the Braita that suggested that you needed a tziyun for a beta press. And then we brought the Braita, the Mishnah from Psachim, that told us that by a beta press, you can blow your way through and you can go through and there's no problem of tumat ohel. And we had Rav Papa's answer, which is there are two types of beta pras. There's a beta pras which has a kever that was lost inside of it. And we also have a beta pras in which a kever was plowed over through it. So there you have different types of beta pras. Some of them will have a problem of tumat ohel. Some of them will not have a problem of tumat ohel. And that will solve our problem in the stira between the different types of beta pras that we found. One that is metameh betumat ohel, and one that is not metameh betumat ohel. And now the Gemara says, "Visadeh shenechrash ba'kever beta pras karile," a field in which a kever was plowed through it, that's called a beta pras. On the other hand, the Gra has an alternate gersa, which is "Visadeh she'avad ba'kever beta pras karile," that's called a beta pras. Gemara says, "In vatnan," we have a Mishnah that indicates that that's the case. Shlosha beta prasein, the three different types of beta pras. Sadesh in Evad Bakever, a field in which a grave was lost, meaning that they knew there was a grave there, they just don't know where it is. In that case, then the problem is Tumata Ohel, and one would have to mitzayin that fact because people might go through there and have a problem of becoming Tameh. Sadesh in Echrash Bakever, a field in which there was a grave that was plowed over. In that instance, we do not worry about Tumata Ohel, we do worry about Tumat Heset, and we have to deal with the Tumata Heset by blowing through it or looking through it. As Tosfot and Rashi mentioned, that's a Chumra Ba'alma for Tarot. But with regards to Mitzayin, we're not going to indicate that that field has Tumah in it. Uste Buchin, and the Gra has an alternate Girsa, which is Ste Kuchin. Maiste Buchin, what is this field of crying, or Ste Kuchin, the field of catacombs? Rav Yeshua Bar Abba Mishmed Ulo Amar, Sadesh Maftirim Bat Meitim. It's a place where they take leave of the mate. So now, as Rashi indicates over here, this is a mate that was transported over long distances. And this was the passing of the baton from those people that transported the mate until that point to the people who will bury the mate from there forward. And so they exchange the mate in that field. That's what Rashi describes here. Shemevim meitim makom lamakom likvor. They're bringing a mate from one place to another place to bury them. Shebeim besadeh samuch le'ir. Once they reach a field near the city, Niftarim Elu Sheviyam Mimakuman, the people who brought him from afar, they depart, they leave the mate there. And the people from the local city who are going to take care of the burial, they come and meet them. They receive the mate, they take over the mate. Virochotzim Otansham. And they also, it seems to be, they did a tahara for the mate there in the field. Vikovrin Otan, and they take care of the burial from that point forward. So why in a stable chin is it called a beta pras? What are we afraid of in that indication? The problem is that we're afraid that people are going to give up. What does it mean that they're going to give up? They transported the mate from so far, and something of the mate or a piece of the mate falls off. They're tired. They've worked so hard. They're about to leave. They're just going to leave. They're not going to go search for that piece of the mate and go find what was left behind. So there is a possibility that some of the mate will fall off or be lost in this field. And because there's a little bit of a diffusion of responsibility because you're passing it from one group to the other group, there's a possibility that a piece of the mate fell there. And that's what we're worried about in that case of coming into Tumah. Now the Gemara says, V'sadesh nechrash ba'kever lo ba'itziyun. Our suggestion now is that there's a difference between a field in which a kever is lost, which has a risk of Tumat Ohel. In that case, we will put up a tziyun. We will demarcate it. On the other hand, a field that has a grave that has been plowed over through it, in that case, we will not demarcate it because there is no Tumat Ohel. There might be problems of Tumat Maga or Tumat Heset, but that we deal with as a Chumra for Tarot. We blow through it. If it's been walked over, we take care of it. But as far as demarcating it, we will not demarcate it because of the fear that people will be Mitameh Tarot for no reason in that case. So the Gemara says, is that really true, that you do not have to demarcate that field? Batanya, matzasa de mitzuyenet. The person finds a field that is demarcated. Veyandua mativa. He doesn't know what the story with this field is. Yesh ba'ilanot, if it has trees in it. Beyadua shenech rach ba'kever. Then for sure, it is a plowed over kever. Ein ba ilanot, if it doesn't have trees there, but yadua shavad ba kever, then you know for sure that it was a kever that was lost there. The assumption being that if there are trees there, then the field was plowed for the trees. And since the field has trees and it was plowed over, then there is no likelihood, or very little likelihood, that you can have a problem of tumata oil now, because if there was a mate there, it was dragged around by the plow, and it's no longer a problem of tumat oil. But you see here that the field is demarcated, and now you're just trying to assess what is the demarcation for. Is the demarcation telling you that there's a kever that's lost here, and that's why it's demarcated? Or is it a fact that there was a kever here and then it was plowed over? But you can see that the demarcation indicates both things, both the plowed field as well as a field shenevad ba kever. So that would undermine our assumption that a field that has a kever that was plowed through on it does not require a tziyun, does not require a demarcation. So from here you say, yesh ba'ilanot v'edua shenechvash kever, ein ba'ilanot v'edua she'avad ba'kever. Rabbi Yehuda omer, ad she'esham zakeinu tamid l'fi she'en hakol bikim ba'davar. You need an expert there. You need a Talmud Chacham or a Talmid Chacham or a Zakein, someone who knows the story of the field, before you make any decisions. Because we can't rely on people's assumptions. We can't rely on people's understanding of the situation, because people don't really know the halachot so well. So you want to rely on somebody who really knows the situation, either because they know the halacha or because they know the history of the field. But without that, we don't want to make any decisions. Amar Rapapa, so Rapapa solves the problem. He's the one who gave us that differentiation before. He explains this brighter now, says, Kitanyo hayi b'sadeh shavad ba'kever. The case here is simply, it's a field that a kever was lost in it. They knew someone was buried there, but just didn't know where. Ditzainua. And they demarcated it. They made a demarcation to show that there was a kever in there. Now, after that fact, after they've demarcated, after they've indicated there's a kever lost in there, then, yesh ba'ilanot, if there are trees there, be'adua shenechrash ba'kever, then you know that the kever got moved around, because the people are going to go plow the field for the trees. They don't want to lose the trees. They're not worried about the tumah, meaning that they can become tamei. They're not worried about doing a korban pesach now. They're not worried about tarot right now. They're just going to go plow their field. So if it has trees there and the field needs plowing, they're going to plow the field. So then in all likelihood, if there was a lost kever in there that was demarcated, now it's been plowed over. Ein ba ilanot, if there are no trees in that area, biyadua shavad ba kever, then you know for sure that there was a kever that was lost in it. Whether the biyadua here means they know for certain, like it means in the beginning, or that yadua means in all likelihood. That's the way Tosfot reads it, possibly, that it means in all likelihood. That means that you have a kever that is lost in this area. So basically, the demarcation came to tell you that there was a kever lost in it. Now we want to assess, post that fact, that we know that there was a kever there, what is the status of that kever? Well, that will depend on whether there are trees there or not trees there. If there are trees there, the assumption is that it was plowed over, because nobody's going to leave their field and not plow it. So you know that it was demarcated for tuma, and then it got plowed over. Now, what does that demarcation tell you? It means that it's a sadeh shenevad ba kever, but not that they marked it because it was a sadeh shenechrash ba kever. When they marked it, it wasn't plowed. They marked it when there was a kever that was lost in it. But then it got plowed afterwards because of the circumstances or the reality of this field that it has trees in it. On the other hand, if they mark it and there's no trees there, then you can assume that they're not going to plow it over, and it remains in that status of sadesh nevad ba'kever. So in terms of demarcation, we only mark fields that have tumat olel, only mark fields that have a kever lost in them. We're not going to mark a field that has a kever plowed over on it, but once you've marked a field that has a kever lost in it, then the nature of the field will affect what is going to happen. If it's a field that's going to get plowed over, then you know that it's going to be a sadesh nechrash ba'kever, even though it was demarcated for a lost kever because of the plowing. Again, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees and says you need more information before you can make such a decision. The Gemara says, why are you so certain that it got plowed over? V'lichosh dilma ilanot mi gavai v'kever mi b'rai. Maybe the trees are on the inside of the field, and the kever was buried on the edge of the field. So how do you know for sure that it got plowed over? Maybe that the plow never got there because it's not in the area where the trees are. Talking about a case here where the trees are standing on the border around it. So to in our case, the trees stand on the border. So he's definitely not going to bury the mate in the Reshut HaRabim. This is a field that's adjacent to Reshut HaRabim. So he's not going to bury it in the Reshut HaRabim. He's never going to bury it in the field. If the trees are right around the edge of the field, then in all likelihood it got plowed, because they're going to plow the trees there, and the kever was there, and it's going to get plowed over. So hachanamis, that's our case here. Boom demalik bulim. Mar says, v'dilma tuma migavai vilanot mibarai. So let's just assume that it's the opposite case now. Because you could assume that the trees are now on the border of the field, and the kever is found somewhere in the middle of the field, and it won't get plowed over. So we have two answers to that. B'mesubachim. where the trees are dispersed all over the field. So there's no possibility that the field wasn't plowed, because by the nature of the distribution of the trees, then they're going to end up plowing the whole field. And that's why it's going to be a sedesh nechrash bakever, because the assumption is that it definitely was plowed. V by Tema, and an alternative answer is, Had Amran, Ein Rakakim Tziyun, Bimakom Tuma, Shalol Lafsid Et Eretz Yisrael. The fact that the field was demarcated, then the person knew for sure that that area had contained the kever in this specific area that was near the trees. They're not going to demarcate a large area, assuming that the kever is here, because we said before that we don't want to increase the amount of tuma inside of Eretz Yisrael. And since the demarcation is close to the trees, you can assume that the tuma is in proximity to the trees, a place where they're going to plow. And that's why we can assume that even if it was demarcated for a lost kever, once that area gets plowed over, then it's definitely a sedeshin nechrash ba kever, and not a sedeshin evad ba kever. And that's why this tziyun, again, is no longer relevant. The tziyun was relevant beforehand until they plowed it. But now that they plowed it, it becomes a sedeshin nechrash ba kever. The tziyun was there from beforehand and is not demarcating the plowed field, but that is what it is now, because we know by the nature of the field that it will be plowed over. Now the Gemara goes back to discuss Rabbi Yehuda's position. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ad Shei Sham Zakeinu Tamid, Defi Shein HaKol Bikiyim Badavar. We need evidence. We need other evidence as to what happened here, because not everybody understands the situation. So we want either a Talmud Chacham who understands the situation, or a Zakein who was present there when this all happened and knows the background to the field. So Amar Abayi Shema Minot. From this you can conclude, Tzurba Mi Rabbonon Deika B'mato. If you have a young Talmud Chacham in the city, Komilei D'mato Lei Ramyo. He has to be involved. He has to be engaged in that which is going on in the city. He is responsible to make sure that things are carried out halakhically in a proper manner, as well as to be involved in different issues of the city. It's not that he can sit in the Beit Midrash and ignore everything that's going on. He has to be a participant in the nature of what is taking place in the city. Right now, we have another statement. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Matzab Evin Mitsuyenet. You find a rock which is demarcated that has the sid, the white on it. Tachtea Tamei. Underneath it, you can assume, is Tameh. Now, we said before, in terms of demarcations, that you never demarcate the exact location where the Tumah is, because by the time the person figures out they're at the Tumah, it's already too late. So you always have to demarcate in a perimeter that's around it, so that you know before you get to the area of the Tumah. So Rashi asks over here, he says, then we just see back on yesterday's daf, that you have to give some room for demarcation. So why, when you demarcate the rock, do we assume that the tuma is below the rock? So Rashi explains that there's a difference between a rock and normal demarcations. Normal demarcations are talking about flat areas. So therefore, if you don't demarcate it, the people won't know that they're coming upon the tuma. On the other hand, when you're talking about a rock which rises from the ground, a person's not going to happen upon a rock by accident. They're going to come, it's a rising above the ground, they're going to know that it's there. So there you only have to demarcate the rock itself. You don't have to demarcate the area around it. On the other hand, the way that the Nimuka Yosef and others explain it is that when the Gemara said before that you demarcate around the area where the Tumah is, they don't simply demarcate the area around, they also demarcate the area where the Tumah is. So that just means the circumference or the proximity that you demarcate and not the area inside, rather you demarcate all of it. And that's the same thing over here. When you demarcate the stone, it's the stone plus the areas a little bit around the stone. That means that the Tumah is under the stone. So that's our assumption here. If there is seed, if there's this lime, this whitewash on the stone, then you can assume that the tuma is below the stone. Now, on the other hand, if you find two stones, shtayim, im yesh sid b'nehem, b'nehem tamei. If you have two stones, then that are demarcated, then, and the place between them also has some sort of demarcation, then the space between them is also considered to be tamei. Then we assume that the rocks are perimeter, meaning that they are giving you the extent of the tuma, and that between them is really the area where the tuma is. Im ein sid b'nehem, if there is no seed between them, then b'nehem tahor. Between them is considered to be tahor. So that's the question here. When you have two rocks that are demarcated, are they giving you a perimeter and explaining to you that the tumah is between them? Or are we assuming here that each rock has something tamei below it, but what's in between is not problematic? So this, at least this memra, according to Rabbi Yehuda, says that if you have two rocks that are demarcated, if there is coloring, whitewash between them, then you can assume there's tumah between them. If there is no whitewash between them, then Benehem is tahor. Between the two rocks is fine. The rocks themselves are problematic underneath them. Vafagav deleka choresh. Even though there is no area to plow, or there's not enough room to plow between the rocks. Again, we're going to explain this in a second. Tosfot has a different gear. Vafagav deleka cheres. even though there is not cheres, which is another type of whitening agent. We're going to go with Rashi's explanation, Delecha Choresh, where it says, Vatanya, is that really true? We have a Braita. Same thing that Rabbi Yehuda said, if you find a single rock that is whitewashed, then you assume the tumah is underneath it. Shtayim, if you find two rocks, im yesh choresh b'nehem tahor. If it's an area you can plow between, then they are tahor, between them. Bim lav b'nehem tameh, then between them is considered to be tameh. So here you have a braita that seems to indicate otherwise to what Rabbi Yehuda said. Rabbi Yehuda said before that if there is no sid between them, even though there is no plowing space there, it's still considered to be tameh. On the other hand, here we have a braita that says that im yesh choresh, then it's tahor. If there's no choresh, then it is tameh. So that's the opposite of what Rabbi Yehuda says. The braita suggests that only if there's a plowing space between them is it considered to be tahor, whereas the Rabbi Yehuda's statement was that even though there is no choresh there, then it's considered to be tahor, and our braita says that that's considered to be tameh. So Rav Papa again, like he's done throughout the sugya, comes to reconcile and says, "Hachav she'asid shafuch al roshehen umiruda dekan dekan." So it's a case where there was lime, there was whitewash poured on the two rocks, and it extends out beyond the rocks into the space between them. Iika choresh b'nehem. If you see that there's an area that can be plowed between them, then b'nehem tor. Then between the rocks is tor. De'imor machmat choreshu de'ikpal. Because we can assume that because of the plowing, it got peeled off the rocks, and that's why there's white between the two rocks. Velo. If not, then sidi de beni benihu. Then it's definitely a demarcation of lime that was put between them, vitameh. So Rapapa's reconciliation is, once you've had this whitewash that is on the rocks, and then it spills over into the space between them. When it spills over into the space between them, what is our assumption? Is the fact that there is whitewash between them mean now there's tumah between them? Because that's why there's whitewash that falls in between them. Or are we assuming that really the tumah is under the rocks? And the whitewash that's between them came there for whatever reason. That's, we'll explain in 1 second what that reason is. So that's the question that we have. So Rav Papa comes and says, well, it depends on the space between them. If there is an inability to bring a plow between them, then if there is whitewash between them, you can assume that it is tameh, because the person who poured it intentionally poured it in such a way that it would spill over into the middle to indicate that between them is tameh. And that's why you have whitewash between the two rocks. On the other hand, if there's enough space to plow between them, you can assume that they plowed between them. And so once they plowed between them, the whitewash that is found between them now is not because it was poured there, but rather it's because of the friction of the plow against the rock. The friction of the plow against the rock caused some of the whitewash to peel off the rock and now come into the space between them. And the reason there's whitewash between them is not because someone intended for it to be there. It came there because of the activity that was there, the plowing that went on there. So that's why we're going to explain the braita. The braita is in a case where if you can plow it, then it's considered to be accidental or unintentional that there's whitewash there. It was the cause by the plow going through there. On the other hand, when there is no room to plow through there and there is whitewash between them, then it's considered to be tameh because there was no reason to believe that it came there from an exogenous variable, but rather it was poured there intentionally, and that's why it's tameh between the two rocks. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda's statement, who says, "Im ein sid b'nehem tahor," if there is no sid between them, tahor, afagav deleka choresh, even if there's no plowing space, that's because there is no whitewash between them. If there's no whitewash between them, then it's not tameh. So the braita is talking about a case where there is whitewash between them. Rabbi Yehuda is talking about a case where there is no whitewash between them. For him, it doesn't matter whether you plow or don't plow. The lack of whitewash means that there's nothing there. Now, certainly, if there's whitewash there, then the assumption would be that he wouldn't have plowed through there over the whitewash and ruined it. So because of that assumption, we believe that if there's no whitewash between them, there is no tumah between them. On the other hand, the braita, so I made a case where there is either residual or whitewash or something there that makes it look like there was some whitewash there. Now the question is, why is it there? If it's there because he plowed through there, then it's tahor because we assume that it was caused by the plow. On the other hand, if it's there and there was no plowing, then we assume that it was intentionally placed there and there is tumah between the rocks in that case. Amar Rabbi Yasi, Meitzar echad mitzuyan, hu tamei v'chol asadeh kula tohora. If you have one of the boundaries of a field that is demarcated, then you can assume that the tumah is below that area. That area was a border between fields. In the border between the fields, they used to make a path. They used to raise the dirt over there a little bit so that you could demarcate just put rocks and other things there, but also raise it above the ground of the field so you could walk across there. So the assumption is, if it's demarcated, then somebody or something was buried over there, and that's why it's problematic. But the assumption is that it's demarcating the location itself, but nothing more than that. Shnayim, if you have two borders that are demarcated, Haim Tamei, and both of the borders are considered to be Tamei, Chosadeh Gula Tehorah, but the remainder of the field is Tehor. Shlosha, if you have three borders that are demarcated, Haim Tameim, V'cholosadeh Kula Torah, they are Tameim, and the entire field is considered to be Torah, because again, we assume that the Tumah is underneath one of those borders, and that's why they are demarcated. Arba'ah, but if four sides of the field are demarcated, Haim Torahim, they, the demarcations, the Meitzar, the borders themselves are Torahim, V'cholosadeh Kula Tameyah, but the entire field is considered to be Tameyah in that case. Damar Mar, how do we know this? The Ein Marchikim Tziyumi Makom Tumash Lo Seedet Eretz Yisrael. Because you don't move the demarcation far away from where the Tumah is in order to not make excess Tumah inside of Eretz Yisrael. So the way Rashi explains it, L'hachi Tziyain Kol Arba Mitzarav, why did he demarcate all four corners? Etei Kol HaSadeh Nitmah. U'btziyon Demetzar Achad Lo Sagi, D'lkulo De Ein Marchikim Tziyumi Makom Tumah. One of the sides is not sufficient to indicate that it's the whole field, because you don't move the tzion away from where the tumah is. But here we have four sides. A person's making a clear message or clear indication that the tumah is found inside of the field. And since we won't distance the demarcation from where the tumah is, therefore if it's just one side, two sides, or three sides, then the assumption is that the tumah is under the demarcation. Once you got into four sides already, then we assume that the tumah has got to be on the inside, and therefore there's a demarcation on the outside. And again, the demarcation on the outside, we're going to assume that he's giving you time to know where the Tumah is, and therefore the Tumah is inside the field and not under the borders. And as Tosfot says over here, the reasoning that Ein Marchikim may not be coming to explain why the field on the inside is Tameh, but actually it's coming to explain why underneath the borders it is Tahor. Because Ein Marchikim, or the Girsa that Tosfot has, is Ein Ma'amidin. Not Marchikim, but Ein Ma'amidin Tziyun. We don't put up a Tziyun in Makom HaTumah Shelo Shaveda Eretz Yisrael. That we don't put up a markation by the Tumah in order not to lose out on the Tarot of Eretz Yisrael. So, like we saw in the previous daf, where you have to give some spectrum or perimeter around it, so too over here. The marking of the borders gives you that buffer, and therefore that's why we assume that the buffers are Tahor and the field is Tameh. On the other hand, if you read Ein Marchikin as the gears over here, then it's explaining why the field on the inside is Tameh, not why the borders are Tahor. Okay, now we move on to the next line in our Mishnah, which is Yotzin Afal Kilayim. During Chol Moed, they're allowed to go out the messengers of Beit Din to deal with Kilayim. So where it says, V'Kilayim B'Cholom Shol Moed Nafkinan? We really go out on Chol Moed to deal with Kilayim. Don't we have the Mishnah in Shkalim, which we mentioned when we discussed the Mishnah, which is V'Reminu? On the first of Adar, they announce about giving the shekel, the chatzi shekel to Kodesh, in order to have the new fiscal year of the Mikdash. And they also announce about getting rid of the kilayim. This is the time where items start to emerge in the field. It's after the rainy season. And so now you begin to see where there's kilayim, that you have to rid the fields of kilayim. On the 15th, they read the Megillah in the major cities. Yotzin the kaveta the drachim, they go out to clear the roads from the thorns, ula takena rechovot, and to smooth out and fix the roadways, vilamud hamikvaot, and to measure the mikvaot, vosim kotzeche rabim, and they do anything that's necessary for the rabim, umitzayanim et hakvarot, and they also demarcate the kvarot, the tumah, yotzin ala kilayim, and at that point they go out and check out the kilayim, and they announced about it 2 weeks earlier. Now they're going to go out, the Shluchei Beit Din are going out to check on it, and they're going to make sure that the Kilayim has been taken care of. So there are a number of questions about this Mishnah we'll discuss in 1 second. Rabbi Loza, Rabbi Yossi Bachanina, Chad Amar, Kan Be'Bachir, Kan Be'Afil. One is talking about the early growth items, and one is the later growth items. Bachir, like the word Bechor, that comes earlier. Afil, like Afilah, dark, is in the later season. So you have different types of things that emerge. Things emerge early in Adar. That's taken care of by the shluchim that go out on the 15th of Adar. The stuff that comes out later, that gets taken care of during Chol HaMoed. Chad Amar, kan bizraim, kan birakot. That's one of them says, no, it's dealing with zera, with seeded items, with tvua, grains, but kan birakot, and dealing with vegetables. So the vegetables emerge later, so that's when they go out for kilayim later. Bizraim emerge earlier, so there they go out on the kilayim earlier. So there are actually two zmanim for the kilayim. Now, there are a number of questions about the Mishnah. First of all, why does the Mishnah mention reading the Megillah on the 15th and doesn't mention reading the Megillah on the 14th? So it could have said the 14th, but the truth is that the 15th has much more to it than the 14th. The 14th just has Kriyat HaMegillah. The 15th has Kriyat HaMegillah plus all the other items that we mentioned here. So Kriyat HaMegillah is just mentioned in passing because it happens to be one of those items that takes place on the 15th, not because the Mishnah is trying to tell you everything that happens during the month of Adar. In addition to that, Rashi notes here that, why don't we ask about Siyun Kvarot? Over here in the Mishnah it says they go out and mark the Kvarot, the Tumah, and then again in our Mishnah it says they go out on Chol HaMoed and they mark it again. Why does the Gemara not worry about the fact that you're doing it twice? So the answer in the Gemara in Shkalim, as well as Rashi brings over here, is the fact that it's in all likelihood there's going to be rain in between. And since there might be rain in between, it's going to wash away whatever you marked from the 15th. So there, the assumption is that you're going to have to do it again, because if it rains or something happened in between in the interim, there's going to be problems, both the roads and with the demarcations. But with Kilayim, which is all about growth, why is it that you need it at two times? The answer to the Gemara is that things emerge at different times, and so there are actually two time periods for the growth. Now, Amar Abasi, Amar Yochanan, Lo Shanu El She'en Nitzan Nikar. That's only true if their flower is not yet recognizable. Ava Nitzan Nikar Yotzin Alein. If their flower is recognizable, then you go out on them even earlier than that period of time, meaning before the Adar period or before the Chol HaMoed time. This is the time period where we go out, which is the normal time to go out. But if it's an early year where everything is emerging early and flowering early, then we're going to go out earlier than those times if it's necessary. So Gemara says, Maishna b'chol shemoed denafkinan. Why do we have them go out, the shluchim go out on Chol HaMoed? We understand they go out in Adar, the 15th of Adar, because that's the time period where things begin to emerge. Why Chol HaMoed? If I had to pick, I would not pick Chol HaMoed. I would pick any other time besides Chol HaMoed. Why specifically on Chol HaMoed do we have the Shulchan Beit and go out and deal with this issue? So I'm Rabbi Yaakov, I'm Yochanan, Mishum Schar Pula de Mosli Gaban. Because it's much cheaper to find workers during that period of time. And Chol HaMoed, there's no work because nobody's doing work. So since there's no work, you have workers that are available to do the work at a much lower pay. So this will save Beit Din money. So in order to save the Beit Din money or the public money, we have the shluchim go out during Chol HaMoed. You have to assume here that we're talking about poalim, workers that have nothing to eat. That's one of the dispensations that we talk about in the beginning of the Masechta for Avodah on Chol HaMoed, is someone who doesn't have anything to eat. He's allowed to go out and work during Chol HaMoed. Tosafot gives an alternative answer, which is it's Mishum Mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of the Rabbim. It's a mitzvah to do. So even if he doesn't need it, work, nevertheless, he'll do it because the Beit Din needs it and it's a mitzvah. So one of those two reasons you're allowed to do this work on Chol HaMoed. The reason we do it specifically on Chol HaMoed is to save money for the public who's going to have to fund this program. We're going to have them go out during Chol HaMoed when it's cheaper to hire people because there's no other work that is available. So Amar Rav Zvid, V'itemar Rav Misharsha, Shema Minah, you can conclude from this, Ki Yavinan Lahu Skar, when we pay these individuals who work on behalf of Beit Din, Mitruma Lishka Yavinan Lahu, we give it out of the Trumat Lishka, meaning from the collection of the Chatzi Shekel from the public coffers. Because if you think that we force the owners to pay for the Shluchei Beitin, why would we care about what the price is? Meaning that if we're going to obligate the person whose field has Kilayim in it to pay the workers who come in and take care of the Kilayim, then it should be irrelevant to us what the price is because someone else is going to carry the cost. The Balim who didn't take care of this are going to carry the cost of it. So why should we worry about whether it's cheap or not cheap? The only reason to worry about bringing in cheap labor or making sure that it doesn't cost too much is if it's the public responsibility. It's the public responsibility, then we want to make sure that the money is spent well. It's the opposite usually of what happens when there's public money, people spend it without consideration because it's not their money. It's other people's money, they're willing to spend it. But here the Gemara is very careful. It says that if it's public money, then we want to be certain that we're using the lowest price individuals and that we're doing it in a way that saves the tzibur money. On the other hand, if it's going to be an individual who's going to be responsible for it, then we're not going to demand that we use the lowest price labor because it's a problem with the people who didn't take care of what they were supposed to take care of, take out the kilayim of their field. Vad kamo, this is an independent statement about how much is considered to be kilayim. How much of a mixture or other stuff has to be in there in order to be classified as kilayim. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchak, Oto Shoshanino, like we learned in the Mishnah, Kosa'a, any sa'ah sheish barova hakav zera mimin acher, any sa'ah that has a quarter of a kav worth of zera from a different, a seeding from a different min, yima'et. You have to reduce it, you have to get rid of it. So rova hakav is 1/24 of a sa'ah. Is there 6 kav in a sa'ah? And now you're talking about a quarter kav. So a quarter kav, 4 times 6 is 24. So it's 1/24. So if the area contains 1/24, that ratio of 24 to 1, then that 1 becomes a problem, and you have to get rid of that 1. If it's less than that, it's batel, and it's not an issue. It's not considered to be significant enough that we have to deal with it. Don't we have a braita that they don't go out and pull out the kilayim in that case, which is what's indicated by the Mishnah we saw there, is that you remove the kilayim that's there. We rather have the solution being that they're mafkir the sadeh, and it becomes a free-for-all. The public can come in and do what they want with the sadeh. It says, lokasha, kanu kodim takana, kanu achar takana. There were stages in the institution of these takanot of the chachamim had to deal with recalcitrant balabatim who were not dealing with their kilayim. So here are the stages of them. Titania, berishona ayu akrim, umashlechim lifnei behemtan. The shluchei beitin used to come, take out the kilayim, and throw it in front of the animals of the owner. Vayu balei batim smechim shtei smachot. The owners were really happy. Double happiness here. Why? Achat shemenat shim lahem sdoteen. First of all, they're weeding their fields for them, taking out the kilayim. Vachat shemashlechim lifnei behemtan. And on top of that, they're giving them feed for the animals. So it was a win-win for them. Why bother taking out the kilayim when you can have the shluchei beitin come do the work for you and end up getting feed for your animals? So kinu shei okrim umashlechim al drachim. So they changed the takana and said that the individuals who are working on behalf of Beit Din would come in, take out the kilayim, not leave it by the owner, but throw it out into the public domain so that people can use, the public domain can use it for feed. It wouldn't necessarily accrue to the benefit of the owner of the field. They were still happy about this because these shluchei Beit Din for free were weeding their fields out of the kilayim. So they came down to the final solution of hefker Beit Din hefker, which is that Beit Din said then, if you're not going to take care of your kilayim, we're going to make the field hefker, and anybody, it's a free-for-all, anybody can come in and take what they want, because you're causing us the extra work to get rid of the kilayim, and you're not dealing with it, so the penalty will be that you're going to lose the field. That way you don't get any benefit. You're not getting benefit from the weeding, you're not getting benefit from the feed, you're not getting benefit from the field anymore, and that's the punishment for not dealing with your kilayim. Therefore, it's going to be more efficient for you to deal with it than for us to deal with it. If you deal with it, you get to keep your field. You give, leave us to deal with it. Yeah, you're going to get free weeding, but it ain't going to be your field anymore. And therefore, you're going to have a problem. And that's what it means here, that the different stages. We talked about Yimait and the Mishnah is when the original stages of the Takana, when they used to just remove the Kilayim. Or maybe when the Balabait himself is doing it, that's what it's called. But later on, once the people became more and more difficult to deal with, and they were refusing to abide by the restrictions of Kilayim, and they were getting a benefit because the Beit Din was sending in to take care of it, then they said, that's not going to work. We have to penalize these people by taking away their fields. And that's what the Braita was speaking about, that you're mafkir the fields. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Moshkim et ha-mayim ilan le-ilan. You're allowed to drag the water, draw the water from tree to tree. As long as you do not cause the whole field to be watered. So here we're talking about a steabal in general. We're talking about a field that is watered by rain. But because there are trees there that require a lot of water and the rain will not suffice for them, therefore we allow you to water those trees and move the water between tree to tree because it's pseida yeteira ika. There's a heavy duty loss if you don't take care of this. And therefore it's similar to, okay, a shtei shlachin. Then it's like a field that is irrigated. Just like in a field where it's irrigated, if you don't water it, you're going to lose in a big way because everything's going to die. So to over here, this steabal that has trees in it, if we don't allow you to move the water from tree to tree, you're going to also lose out big. So the trees themselves have a status of shtei shlachin, and that's why you can water them or deal with them on Chol HaMoed. But the whole field as a whole, that you can't do, because the remainder of the field, it's not necessary to water it. Zraim shelo shatu lifnei HaMoed, seeds or plants that were not watered before Chol HaMoed, lo yashkem b'moed. Then you don't have permission to water them during Chol HaMoed. If you didn't deal with it beforehand, then the absence of water should not be an issue, because if it really meant something, you would have watered them before Chol HaMoed as well. The fact that you didn't water them before means that they're going to survive just fine during Chol HaMoed. You don't need to water during Chol HaMoed. The Chachamim are matir in both of these instances, both in the case by the Ilanot that you can water the entire field, as well as in the case of the Zra'im that didn't drink beforehand, you're allowed to have them, or to give them to drink, water them on Chol HaMoed. As Rashi notes over here, the machloka that we find in our Mishnah is between the Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim is the same machloka that we saw before with the Shita of Rabbi Meir. If you remember, we had a three-way machloket about the din of working on Chol HaMoed and what you're allowed to water. And over there, we established that Rabbi Yehuda was the author of our Mishnah. We said Rabbi Meir certainly cannot be the author of our Mishnah from that bright, because Rabbi Meir believes that you can water a field both for pseida, for loss, as well as harvacha, for benefit. You're still, even if there's just an upside to you, an opportunity cost for not watering, you're allowed to water the field. So what Rashi suggests over here, that the Chachamim in our Mishnah is that Shita of Rabbi Meir, who says that even when there's no financial loss incurred, but simply that you lose out on a benefit, an opportunity cost, you're allowed to water. And that's the Chachamim here. Blazim and Yaakov says no. You're only allowed to water when there's Hefsid or Hefsid Merubah. That's when you're allowed to water. So he gives you the parameters. Again, the trees, yes. The field, no. By the areas that weren't watered beforehand, you can't water them on Moed. Chamim come along. This is the Chamim, our Rabbi Meir, who says, not only can you water for Pseida, you're giving water for benefits, upside benefit. So therefore, you can water the whole field by the trees, and you can also water the Zra'im that were not watered before Chol HaMoed. You can water them on Chol HaMoed. I'm Rabbi Yehuda. Maita Sadeh Mitunenet. If it is a field that is mitunenet mutar, then it is okay. Now, mitunenet, it's hard to define over here. The Rishonim have different approaches to what mitunenet is. One is the possibility, Rashi says it's lechavi yevesha. It's both moist and dry at the same time. Now, whether that means that there are patches that are dry, patches that are moist, or does it mean that it's a field that normally is moist that has dried out? Or some of the Rishonim explain that mitunenet means that it's harder soil. It's an area where the soil is clayer. It has more clay to it, or clay substance to it, and therefore the water sinks down. It's much more porous, and the water sits down below, and therefore requires additional watering, even though you watered it beforehand, and it should be sufficient. You need to water it more because of the nature of the soil. So in that case, Rebita says, mutar, you're allowed to water it. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports that understanding that mitunenet is mutar. Shamru asur lashkotan b'moed, when you say you're not allowed to water a field during Chol HaMoed, lo amru ela b'zraim. That's only in a case where it's something that did not get watered before the Moed. If they were watered before the Moed, then you can continue to water them on the Moed. If it's Sadeh Mutunenet, then it is Mutar. So whatever the definition of Mutunenet was by Rabbi Yehuda, then here the Braita is seconding what Rabbi Yehuda said, which is that if it is a Mutunenet, you're allowed to water it during Chol HaMoed. Now, V'ein Mashkim Sadeh Grid B'Moed. One is not allowed to water the alternate gears of the grow, as in Marbitzin, Sadeh Grid, B'Moed. A field that is completely dry, you're not allowed to water it during the Chol HaMoed. The Chachamim Matrim, Bazeh u'Bazeh. The Chachamim are Matir in both of these cases. Now, Bazeh, Bazeh, it's not clear what that is modifying in the previous case. Rashi says it's modifying Bazeh Grid. The dry field, you're allowed to water it. And Bzerim Shlosh Shatul Lifnei HaMoed, which is similar to our Mishnah. So basically, the way Rashi is setting up, and Tosfot says it above, Chachamim Matrim, Bazeh, Bazeh, says that this machloket here in the Braita is similar to the machloket in our Mishnah. It's basically Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov versus Rabbi Meir again. The question is a question of harvacha. Are you allowed to water for harvacha? Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says no. Therefore, when it's a loss or a risk of loss, then you're allowed to water it. So that's the case of the Sadeh Mitunenet. Then you're allowed to water it. Areas that were not watered before the Moed for the Zraim, you cannot water them during the Moed. And a field that is dry, completely dry, and therefore seemingly doesn't need water because you didn't water it and was remaining dry, then you can't water it during the Chol HaMoed because obviously there was no loss by keeping it dry. So why should you be able to water it? Again, it's issue of harvacha. So that's the way that Rashi explains it. Amar Ravina. Now, based on Rashi's explanation, Ravina says, Shma Mina, Hai Tarbitza Shari. Tarbitza is mutar. The way Rashi explains tarbitza is sprinkling of water, light watering. As opposed to hashka'a, which is heavy-duty watering, tarbitza is a sprinkling of water. So he says, my tarbitza shari. This watering is considered to be mutar, the tarbutze b'chol demoed, on a gina, on a garden during Chol HaMoed. Why? Sadeh grid, a dried-out field, my taima. Why are you allowed to water it according to the chachamim? The afla mishavilei charfa, because it accelerates the growth of the item that's there. So just like by a dried-out field where it wasn't irrigated, and it didn't necessarily need to be irrigated, why do you water the field? We allow you to water the field to accelerate the growth of those items. So just like there, we allow you to do that acceleration. Al-Khanami afla mishavalei charfa, tarbitza, it's not heavy-duty watering, but the sprinkling of the water on the field is permissible because it accelerates the growth of the item. So Ravina is basically saying, look, the Chachamim say over here that you're allowed to water this dried-out field. So since you're allowed to water this dried-out field, so too, you're allowed to sprinkle on the garden because they have the same effect, which is called the acceleration of that which is growing there. And even though, again, there's no financial loss involved over here, so the tarbutze, you allow you to do this because it's only a light type of sprinkling, a light type of watering. So Tarbitza is allowed. Hashka'ah is not allowed. Hashka'ah is too big an undertaking in this situation, so that we're not going to allow you to do in a gina. So Tarbitza is allowed for the Tarbutze, just like the watering Hashka'ah is allowed for the dried out field. And this was all within the position of the Chachamim. Now, the reason that the other Rishonim don't like Rashi's explanation over here is because of a principle that we have in other places in Shas, which is Mishnah Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Kav V'Naki. That the Mishnah of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is very clear. It is basically lehalacha. That whenever Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov appears in a Mishnah, the halacha is like him. So over here, this would indicate that we are paskening against Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov in this situation, because we are taking up the position of the Chachamim. And Ravina is saying, Shema Minah, from the conclusion of the position of the Chachamim, we can extend and extrapolate out this din. Which means that Ravina is basically saying the halacha is like the Chachamim. It is, the Rov. So you would say that the halacha is like the Chachamim. So the halacha is like the Chachamim are paskening against Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. So other Rishonim don't like that, and you can see that right in the Tosfot. The Kashihi, the Kaimelon, Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar, Kav, and Aki. So why aren't we paskening like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov over here? Vod, Hiksha, B'Tosfot. And in addition to that, we know that Rav Ina said back on Daf Dalid, right on Friday's Daf, Rav Ina said over there with regards to watering vegetables on Chol HaMoed, that over there you're allowed to water vegetables in order to eat them on the Moed itself. But you're not allowed to water the vegetables liaputan in order to make them better. So here you see Ravina back there said Harvacha is not allowed. And all of a sudden over here Ravina is saying that Harvacha is allowed. So what? How could that be? So Viteritz. So the answer that he gave is the Tarbitza eno ki'im hashka purta. That this Tarbitza is different than hashka. So therefore, this is the explanation. The Tarbitza shari the Tarbutze afilu Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. What Tosfot says that based on the differentiation, Rashi makes this differentiation, but he only says it in the position of the Chachamim. Tosfot now says, no, this is true even according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. That which we said that is a sur is hashka'a. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov agrees with hashka'a, that's too big an undertaking. You can only do that for pseida. You can only do that if you have a significant loss involved. But if it's for avacha, if it's simply for opportunity costs or to accelerate, make things better, that you cannot do. But that's only hashka'a. That's when it's a big watering. On the other hand, if it's tarbitza, which is this light sprinkling of water, even Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov will agree that it is mutar because it's not such a big undertaking. Since it's not such a big undertaking, even Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov will agree that you can do this tarbitza, even for avacha. Because again, it's a light amount of work, and it gives you avacha, so that we're going to allow. So that's one way to explain it. Or, the other way he explains it is that Ravina holds, like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, with hashka'a, with regards to watering, and he disagrees with him with regard to harbatza. Meaning that you could argue here that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov still argues with both of these cases, both hashka'a and tarbitza. But Ravina agrees with him with regards to hashka'a, and he disagrees with him with regard to tarbitza. So those are two possibilities of how Tosfot explains this position. Then Tosfot gives another alternative, which is v'yesh mifarshim de plukta de stegrid lavainu plukta de matniten. This machloket about the dry field is not the same machloket as our Mishnah. Demari bar Rav Elazar ben Yaakov v'chachamim uplegi be'afla de shavya churfa. It's talking about when you accelerate the growth. Meaning that there is a difference. Our Mishnah is talking about a case about watering for Arvacha. By Arvacha, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says no, and no legamre. And that's the machloka. That's Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov in the Mishnah. And there we're going to pass like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Arvacha is not allowed. This Brito is talking about a different issue. We assumed until now, and that's what Rashi said, that when you accelerate the growth of an item from being late to early, that's the equivalent of Arvacha. And that's why we assume the machloka in the Brito is the same as the machloka in the Mishnah. Tosfot says, no, those are totally two different issues. One issue is Harvacha, that's our Mishnah. The other issue is making something that would have grown later to accelerate its growth. And Tosfot says that there's an upside and a downside to that. That is, the upside is that it grows faster. The downside is that it doesn't ripen as well and doesn't ripen as fully. So there is some benefit and some loss to that. So the acceleration here of the growth is not necessarily Harvacha. It has a benefit in one sense of growing faster, but has a detriment in the fact that it's not going to ripen to its full state. And so because of that, that's the machlokin in the Braita. The Tanakama choshiv la harvacha. The Tanakama believes that it's the equivalent of harvacha. Like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. He thinks it's like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. The Chachamim disagree and say that the case of moving it up is not a harvacha case. And therefore, then you can reconcile and say even Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov will hold of the Chachamim in the Braita, because they're actually arguing within the position of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Everybody agrees that harvacha is a sur. Question is moving, accelerating the growth considered to be harvacha or not harvacha? Tanakhama says yes. The Chachamim say no. Then Tosva brings the last approach. The Muke Yosef also has an approach like similar to this, but the Rabbeinu Chananel has an approach like this. The Rif paskins like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, and therefore he says even though he's a dat yachid, we paskin like him because Mishnato kavinaki. And then the Rabbeinu Chananel has an interesting explanation, and both the Muke Yosef uses the same type of idea, which is that the statement of Ravina is not a statement, but rather a question. It's not saying yes, it's saying no. The way that we've read it until now, Ravina is extrapolating from our conclusion that if you can water a dry field, then you certainly can sprinkle on the vegetable gardens. Now, the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel is going to read it is that Ravina is coming to say, how could you come to that conclusion? Because if you don't allow it by a degree, if you don't allow it by a dry field, then why would you allow it by the vegetable garden? And you can see this in the Rabbeinu Chananel. It says, Amar Rav Kahana, Shmamina, Har Tarbitza, what is a Tarbitza? Perish Sadesh Eina Zrua Adayin. It's talking about a field that was not yet planted. Shekvar Hishkua Mikodem. They already watered it before Chol HaMoed. Mutar Lashkuta Gam BeMoed, Luzor A Achar HaMoed. You can water it even after the Moed if you've watered it beforehand. Umakshinin Allah. And then they ask a question on that. Garid Amayasur. Why is a dry field not allowed to be watered? Because if you water a dry field, it's going to accelerate the growth. So he says, well, the same thing is true over here. When you're talking about doing this tarbitza, now according to him, tarbitza is not the sprinkling, but rather tarbitza is watering a field that's already been watered. It hasn't been planted. They're going to plant the field, but by watering it, you're going to accelerate the growth of the plants that come afterwards. So why should you be allowed to be watered on Chol HaMoed for that field? Because all you're doing is the similar thing to what you would do in a dry field, which is called acceleration. There we said it's asur. So to here it's asur. That's the question posed by the Gemara, posed here by Rav Kahana, Ravina in the Gemara. And the Gemara is lo ifrak. It has no answer to it. So since the Gemara leaves that as a question, it's actually challenging the position of the Chachamim and the extrapolation. And therefore the Halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is one who says you cannot water a dry field. And the Gemara comes along and challenges this statement about Tarbitza from that case of Garit of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. By the fact that they challenge it from Elazar ben Yaakov's position shows you that they hold like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. And that's how the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it. Tosafot brings that position of Rabbeinu Chananel over here and explains the Nairn for sure. He says it's a real Zesh Shita Holechet Tesfira like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. And this explanation makes a lot of sense because then we're clearly holding like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, because the whole challenge of the Gemara is from the position of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, and then it makes the whole situation much easier to understand. Now the Gemara continues and says, Tarabanan, Marbitzin Stelavan Bishvi'it. One is allowed to sprinkle a field on the Shvi'it of a lo b'moed, and not a chol HaMoed. The Gra has an alternative girsa, which is Ein Marbitzin Stelavan Bishvi'it of a lo, and also on the Moed, meaning that he says it's no for both of them. The way that we have the bright is that you're allowed to sprinkle the Stelavan as a white field, means a grain field, on Shvi'it, but not on Moed. V'hatanyo, don't we have a bright that marbitzim ben b'moed ben b'shvi'it? Don't we have a bright that says you're allowed to sprinkle whether it's chol HaMoed, whether it's shvi'it? Am ravuna lo kasha, that's not a problem. Am ravuna Yaakov harabonon, that's the difference between the positions of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and the rabonon. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is the one who says tarbitza, no, you're not allowed to do it, and the rabonon who say yes. So that's the difference in the brighta. So marbitzin stay lavan b'shvi'it, yes. Moed, no, that's Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. The other bright that says Marbitzim ben Moed ben Shvi'it, that's the Chachamim who say that on Chol HaMoed that sprinkling is allowed. The Marbatza Harvacha is allowed on Chol HaMoed. Then we have Tanya Idach. We have another bright that Marbitzim Stelavan Erev Shvi'it Kadesh Yitzu Yerakot Bishvi'it. One is allowed to sprinkle on a grain field before Shvi'it on the sixth year in order that the stuff that grows during the Shvi'it will come out better. Blood El Shemarzim Stelavan Bishvi'it. You're allowed to water a field on Shvi'it in order that Kadesh Yitzu Yerakot Motzei Shvi'it, that it comes out on Motzei Shvi'it. Now the reason being here, first of all, we have already spoken about this issue of Malacha on Shvi'it, and that Hashka'ah, warding of the ground, is not a big problem. We discussed all the different shitot about why watering is allowed on Shvi'it. But here we're not even talking about watering, we're talking about Harbatza, which is sprinkling, which is even a lighter form, may not even be considered a Malacha Dakarka. So since Harbatza, number one. Number two is we're talking about the growth. So what the Gemara is basically saying is, in order to be problematic on Shvi'it, you have to do the Harbatza on Shvi'it, and has to produce on Shvi'it. If that's the case, we're not going to let you do it. That's going to be considered too close, or basically Avodat HaKarka. But if one of the two items is not on Shvi'it, then we're going to allow it. So if the sprinkling is done before Shvi'it and it grows on Shvi'it, we're okay with that. If the sprinkling takes place on Shvi'it and the growth is after Shvi'it, we're going to allow that. The only thing we're not going to allow is the sprinkling on Shvi'it for Shvi'it. Now, what's interesting over here is that Rashi seems to indicate that v'yashkeh b'Shvi'it k'dei sh'yetzu b'Shvi'it. You're not allowed to add water on Shvi'it in order that it grows on Shvi'it. This goes against Rashi in the Mishnah. The Rashi, our Rashi in the Mishnah, does not have this. There is a Tav Yad, you should know this, that the Rashi on the Gemara here is not considered to be Rashi. It's Miyuchas, the Rashi, it's probably not Rashi. There are Kitvei Yad that are written that do have the Shita of Rashi in them. And Rashi on the Mishnah says that when our Mishnah says that you're not allowed to water the Beit HaBaal on Chol HaMoed, I mean, Mashkin Beit HaShlachim, you're allowed to water a irrigated field on Chol HaMoed, but not a Beit HaBaal, that's only qualifying Chol HaMoed. But Shvi'it, you're allowed to water either field, whether it's a Beit HaBaal, whether it's considered to be a Beit HaShlachim. That differentiation does not exist on Shvi'it. Tosfa points out over here that Rashi seems to be retracting that position and saying that on Shvi'it you can't do something over here. So Tosfa says, why is that? So then he says, well, at first he starts to work with this new position of Rashi, saying, okay, if this is the position of Rashi, then this is the explanation of the Gemara, and Rashi on the Mishnah is wrong. But then in the end he goes, no, you know what? Father Abba, Denir Ali Demayi Vashkag Mura. He says that I think they're talking about full-fledged warding over here. But Nakat Mashkim Begavi Beit Tabal Kori Har Batza. And he says the words are different. We saw this in the Tosfot above, that the word Hashka'a and Har Batza doesn't mean watering and sprinkling, but it's a different verb for watering in different fields. Hashka'a is when you water a irrigated field. Harbatza is when you water a Beit HaBaal, a rain-fed field. So that's it. That's the difference here. It's full-fledged watering. And therefore, Tosfot concludes that the parish of Rashi in the Mishnah makes more sense, and Harbatza is a full-fledged watering, and that Rashi's diuk in the Mishnah was totally correct. This is only about Chol HaMoed, that qualification, not about Shvi'it. Of course, according to the way that we explained it over here, then the machloket would be harbatzah, this lighter form of watering, versus hashka, which is a heavier form of watering. And therefore, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov will allow harbatzah on Shvi'it. He will not allow it on Chol HaMoed. And the Chachamim will say harbatzah is allowed in both of those instances, according to that explanation of Rashi in this Gemara, not on the Mishnah. But Tosfot in the end favors Rashi's explanation in the Mishnah, that on Shvi'it, full-fledged watering is allowed, whether it's a Beit HaShlachim, whether it's a Beit HaBaal. The only consideration is there hefsed or not hefsed. That's the only thing you have to look at. All right, our next Mishnah. Tzadin et ha'ishut ve'et ha'akbarim mistei ilan u'mistei alavan kidarko. A person can capture ishut is either a mole, or Tosafot over here says, Yerushalmi calls it a chuda, which is a weasel. So an ishut is either a mole or a weasel. Ve'et ha'akbarim in the mice, mistei ilan, from trees, that fields of trees, and from grain fields. Kedarko, the normal way you do it, bimoeid, ubishvid, both on Chol HaMoed and Shvi'it, because they're going to wreck the fields. If they're going to wreck the fields, you can capture them. V'chamim or mim istei ilan kedarko. In a tree-lined field, then you can do this. Mistei alavan shlo kedarko. In a grain field, you have to do it in a not normal manner. You have to do some sort of shinoi. Umakrin et ha'pirtza bimoeid. One can fill in a breach in the wall during Chol HaMoed, because it's a hefsed if you don't fill in the breach. Bishvid bonek kedarko. On Shvi'it, you're allowed to build walls like you want, because there's no Isra building on Shvi'it. The Isra is Avodat HaKarka. And this is not Avodat HaKarka when you're building a wall there. So on Chol HaMoed, where the Isra is Malacha, there you have to be careful about this. But with regards to Shvi'it, where the only Isra is Avodat HaKarka, this is not considered to be Avodat HaKarka. My Ishut. What is the Ishut that we said in our Mishnah, the mole, the weasel? Amar Yehuda, Birya Shein La'inayim. It's a creature that doesn't have eyes. I mean, probably doesn't have good eyesight. It moves around at night. Since it moves around at night, the assumption is that it uses other senses to get around and not sight, because it's moving around in the dark. So again, it's a mole, it's a weasel. Amar Rava bar Yishmael, v'itemer Rabbi Yemer bar Shalmaya, Mikra. What is the pasuk that proves this? Kmo shablul temes yaloch. Just like the slimy track of the snail will disappear, evaporates. Nefel eshet balchazu shamesh. So too, the untimely births, meaning a nefel, Eshet of a woman, Bal Chazu Shemesh, they will not see the light, the sunlight. So over here he's playing on the word Eshet, not to mean of a woman, but Eshet to mean this Ishut, this animal. So too, the Nefel Eshet, Bal Chazu Shemesh, that the animal of the Eshet doesn't see the sunlight. So that's the parallel between, just like this happens, so too this happens. So what's the obvious in each of these cases? One is, well, the slime of the snail disappears. So too, either the Nafel, the untimely birth of a child, will then not see the light because it's passed away, it's not alive. Or we could say the Ishut, this animal that doesn't have great eyesight, will not see the sun because it goes around in the dark and doesn't have good eyesight. Tanu Banan, Tzadinat Ishut ve'achbarim miste alavan u'miste alilan ki darcho. U'machrivim chorei nemalim. And you're also allowed to destroy the ant holes or the ant mounds in the fields. Ketzad machrivin. How do you destroy them? Shimon Gamliel omer, mevi afar michorzeh, v'notein letoch chorzeh. He takes the dirt from one of the ant holes and brings it over to another ant hole. V'hein chokin zeh. And then they choke each other. Now either whether that's because they become competitive with each other or because they're not familiar with the dirt and therefore causes them problems. For he believes that if you mix up the two different holes or two different ant colonies, one from here, one from there, that's going to cause them a problem. Amar Rav Yemer bar Shlomaya mishmei debayi v'hu dekayi betrei avrei denaro. That's only true when the two ant holes are found on different sides of the river. V'hu deleka gishwa, and there's no bridge between them which they can go across. V'hu deleka gamla, not only is there no bridge, there's no like wooden plank that goes across that you could cross with, not just a full bridge, but even a plank bridge. V'hu deleka mitzra, or not even a plank, but not a mitzra. A mitzra, over here Rashi translated as a like almost like a tightrope that goes across, a very thin wire, which requires a second wire for you to hold on to slide across the river, because there's not enough footing on the beam or whatever is going across the river. Other times they say mitzra is like a raft or a some sort of ferry that takes people back and forth between the two sides. But basically there is no easy transport between the two sides of the river, and therefore the ants on one side do not recognize the ants on the other side, or don't recognize the dirt on the other side. And therefore, you bring dirt from another location, that will cause them problems. Ad kama. How far does it have to be? Ad parsa. A parsa wide. Now, there are different ways to explain this. Rashi says, Ad kama meruchakim hanitrei chorei nimalim. How far do they have to be? Dehi ganar beinayu v'leka gishra. When they're on two sides of the river, and there's no connection between them, how far away do they have to be? They still have to be a parsa away from each other in order for them not to recognize the dirt. In order to have a different quality of dirt, that'll cause them a problem if you bring it over here. That's only if, number one, they're a parsa away. Plus, there's no way for them to traverse the water that's in between. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosfot, on the other hand, brings two other explanations. De'ei makrim zed zeh biyoter miparsa afilu below nahar. Says one explanation is that that's a second option. If there's no river between them, if they have a distance of a parsa between them, then that is enough to be considered different areas, and the dirt will hurt the ants from one location to the other location. Inami. Or he says like Rashi, which is, when there is a river, you still need a parsa. So the way Rashi and the second answer does we learn is that it's the river plus a parsa that you need in order to consider them to be different locales. And then if you bring the dirt over, it's going to ruin it for the other nimalim. On the other hand, the first explanation Tosfos says there are two different options here. Either they're a parsa away from each other, or there's a river that divides between them, and that's what causes the problem for the different ant holes. If you bring over the dirt from that other location, it's going to confuse them, it's going to choke them, they're not going to be used to it, or there's going to be competition because the other dirt will have other ants in it, and that's going to help you get rid of the ants in your field. Okay, we'll stop over here.